Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature, or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter, nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP, and AEP. On the web at yourfinancialchoices.com, and you can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org. That includes streaming while we're live on the show, or you can tap podcast available on either of those websites as well. Podcast being shows that we've done in the past, and you can look at all the different topics that we've covered. So those are available at wdiy.org or through yourfinancialchoices.com. Today is February 22nd, 2017. The markets were mixed today. The Dow closing up at 20,775. The NASDAQ down a bit at 5860. And the S&P down to at 2362. Just smidges off. So pretty non-eventful there. It is tax time. We are talking about Schedule B. B as in boy. Interest and dividends tonight. But of course, I love callers' questions. I love questions. So if you have any, you're welcome to give us a call. We are live tonight. We'll take the questions either live on air or off air, whatever you're more comfortable. Lori C. is in the studio with us, and she'll write down your question if you don't want to talk live on air. And otherwise, you'll get me and we'll talk, chit-chat. We do ask you to mute your radio if you're going to talk live on air so that you can hear me without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We do discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic. I'll do my best to answer them. The number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. Email is also available at yourfinancialchoices.com. And we will have plenty of time tonight to talk about things. So, because I am not sure that just talking about Schedule B will fill this hour, but I guess regular listeners know I actually don't have problems filling a whole hour just talking either. But I would love questions. That is what makes it fun for me. So Schedule B, B as in boy, what are we talking about? Interest, dividends, and maybe some the trigger to know whether or not you have some foreign account reporting, which I'll talk about at the end if we have time. And some people don't have to file a Schedule B. And frankly, off the top of my head, I don't even recall what the threshold is anymore. I think in the old days, it was like $400 or $500. If your interest and dividends were below that amount, you actually did not have to fill out the schedule. So in my world, we fill out Schedule B. So that's what I'm talking about tonight. But even if you don't have to fill out the Schedule B, because you're under some kind of reporting threshold, you still have to know what the income is that we report on that schedule, because it could impact your federal and your state return. So we want to make sure that you know what you have the right tax documents, and you actually know what the kind of income is on those documents that you're getting, and why is it important to understand them. So let's first talk about interest. So interest is reported on a tax document that has at the bottom of it 1099 INT. Very simple, INT for interest. There's so many different kinds of interest, and what will happen is there's several different boxes on your 1099 that will describe the different kinds of interest that you have. Ordinarily, what most of us are used to seeing on a 1099 INT is the interest that we've earned quite often on a savings account or a money market account. So we might have savings at a bank. We might have cash that we've held in a brokerage account. But if we have money that is in something like a bank, savings account, money market account, high yield checking account, maybe a money market account, your brokerage account, that's going to be interest. And interest income is ordinary income. It's pretty much you see what you get. Ordinary income is taxed at whatever tax rate you happen to be on your tax return. So if you're in a 15% tax bracket and your regular income is above your standard deduction or itemized deduction and your exemptions, then we look in your tax bracket, see how much your taxable income is, and maybe you're in the 15% tax bracket. Basically, your interest, ordinary interest, is going to get taxed at that 15%. What I want to make sure that you understand is there is different kinds of interest. We might have tax-exempt interest, U.S. Treasury bond interest, certain bonds that you buy, maybe corporate bonds that you're buying in between interest payment dates. So I want to talk about there's more to interest than just what appears. But we do have a caller on line one. We have Dennis from Mount Pocono. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Well, how can I help you tonight?
My question revolves around a 1099 R form I received recently.
Okay.
I filed a Chapter 13 bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it was in 2013. I gave the wrong dates earlier.
Okay.
After the Chapter 13 bankruptcy was confirmed and all payments started, I relinquished the vehicle back to Capital One.
Okay.
And I received a 1099-R showing that they forgave this debt this past calendar year in 2016.
Interesting.
So I should consider that essentially as income. I haven't yet contacted my lawyer that handled the bankruptcy itself. But my understanding was that any of those debts handled under the bankruptcy it's not considered a forgiven debt.
Well, Dennis, first of all, I see a couple things going on. The 1099 you received was probably, it's not a 1099-R. It's usually like a cancellation of debt form. I've not normally seen it on that form, but regardless, there's a form that tells you there's some cancellation of debt. Whether or not it's taxable, it depends. So even if someone has not filed bankruptcy, let's pretend someone just has a loan forgiven, a credit card forgiven. I don't have to file bankruptcy necessarily to have a loan forgiven. But so let's pretend I have cancellation of debt besides a bankruptcy. If I am considered insolvent, and don't tell me if you are or not, I'm just going to give you the description. There is a worksheet that we can do with, you can just probably Google insolvency worksheet with the IRS. And there's an insolvency worksheet you can prepare to see if you are solvent or not. If you are not considered solvent, let's pretend you're insolvent by, you know, $10,000 and the forgiveness of debt on this tax document was $4,000. Well, it's not income to you. You don't have to report it because you're insolvent. Now, where sometimes cancellation of debt becomes taxable income is if you are not solvent. So that's one piece of this. So if you're not solvent and they have cancellation of debt, some or all of it might end up coming in as other income on our tax return. Now, where I see an issue is that you filed for bankruptcy, and there are certain debts that are, you know, foregone, I believe. So my confusion here is that you filed for the bankruptcy in 2011. You relinquished the vehicle in 2012. There's certain things you can't get out of in bankruptcy. So depending on the timing of when you got this vehicle, was it included in the bankruptcy? You might want to check back with the attorney. They're probably going to charge you for that time. But I might try to go through that insolvency worksheet first.
Okay.
To see, because if you don't really have any assets, in my story, I'm going to pretend you don't own a home, you don't have a retirement account, and you have, you know, a mortgage, or, well, you do have a home in my story. So you have a home, you have a mortgage. If you're insolvent, then it's not taxable anyway. You would just have to make sure you keep that in your records. Then you might not have to contact the attorney. If you're solvent, then I would probably go through some questions with him, because the timing looks a little weird to me that you relinquished the car in 2012 and they're only now forgiving the debt in 2016. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that is the parts that I absolutely plan on following up with my bankruptcy lawyer for several of those very specific reasons. One of them also being the amount of debt that they're reporting forgiven.
Yeah,
it's a bit high if the vehicle was surrendered. And
right, it makes you wonder how they calculated the forgiveness. If maybe they didn't do something right on their books. So in this case, it might be worth contacting if you think you might not fall under that insolvency issue. Okay.
Well, thank you.
All
very
right.
Much.
Good luck with that. Take care.
Thank
and
you.
Thank you for calling. Have a good night. Folks, we are taking our first break. When we come back, we'll continue to talk about Schedule B interest, and then we'll move on to dividends. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Have you reserved your tickets yet for WDIY's 22nd anniversary party? On Saturday, March 4th, we're celebrating with a night of live music, great food, drinks, and fun at the Ice House in Bethlehem, featuring a performance from Steve Broski and his Big Little Band. Early bird tickets are available until this Sunday. Get your tickets today at WDIY.org. We'll see you at the party.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. We are talking about, tax time. It's that time of year that we spend a lot of time on each of these shows talking about different pieces of your tax return and issues that you want to make sure you address or understand. Help get your bearings during tax time, help you get that tax return prepared a little bit sooner. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. I was talking about interest to start and how we have interest reported on a 1099 INT. And a lot of times people just think, well, interest, bank account interest, and report whatever is there, and they don't always think through everything. So just a few items I wanted to mention about interest. Number one, it's taxed at ordinary rates. There's no special tax treatment on ordinary interest that we get off our bank accounts and CDs and things like that, and corporate bonds. There are some tax favored treatment on other kinds of interest we have that you need to pay attention to, and that is U.S. Treasuries, bonds, bills, savings bonds, any kind of U.S. government obligations. And we don't get that special tax treatment at the federal level. All of that income is taxable for federal, but it's tax exempt for state and local. So U.S. Obligations, direct obligations, are tax exempt for state and local. So it's important when you get those 1099 INTs from your bank, if you have a bank account and also cashed savings bonds in, that you look for the box that says U.S. obligations. And that could also apply and on your brokerage accounts where you get a 1099 INT. Maybe you have some treasuries in your brokerage account. You want to make sure you identify what that U.S. Treasury interest is, because that's not going to be taxable for Pennsylvania purposes. So we want to make sure you're looking at that. I want to talk a little bit more about savings bonds in a minute, but let me tell you some other interest that might have some tax-favored treatment, and that is municipal bond interest. So that's when, again, you might have it in a brokerage account where you have individual municipal bonds that your broker might have purchased for you, or you might have purchased yourself if you manage the account yourself. Municipal bonds, that is state you're funding state projects. You might have a water and sewer bond or a school bond or a, can't think of all of them off the top of my head, but any number of kinds of bonds where you're the state agency, municipality, whatever, is actually borrowing from you, the investor. So you are helping with their infrastructure or whatever it might be. Usually bonds have a special purpose. You invest in those. We get tax favor treatment for federal and state purposes if it is in our state of residency. So for sure at the federal level, municipal bonds, unless there's something called private activity bonds, they might be subject to alternative minimum tax. But other than that, for the most part, our municipal bonds are going to be tax exempt for federal purposes. If I bought a California bond and I am a PA resident, then I'm not going to get that interest that I've earned on the California bond as tax-free for Pennsylvania. So only in our state of residency do we get the tax-free treatment for bonds that we've purchased that back our state municipalities. So municipal bonds can have like a great impact for after-tax rate of returns when we're not paying federal tax or state tax on the interest that we're reporting there. So quite often we see municipal bonds in large portfolios where you have high net worth clients who are trying to control the tax consequences on their tax return. Municipal bonds might be somewhere they would go to get some of that tax-free treatment. Now, you heard me mention corporate bonds, and there's something special about corporate bonds. There's also something special about bonds in general, municipal bonds or corporate bonds. Sometimes people will buy bonds in between dates. So if a municipality, you know, Pennsylvania, you know, wants to build a bridge, and so they issue some bond to raise money, and they issue it on January 1st of 2016, and you buy that bond and you hold it for 20 years or 30 years, however long the bond is, you get interest semi-annually, and then when the bond comes to maturity, you get whatever you paid for the bond. So you get the face of the bond that you bought. But sometimes people will buy and sell bonds in between dates. So if that bond was issued at some rate like 2% on January 1st of 2016, and 3 years later, interest rates are much higher on some other bonds, so I want to sell that 2% bond. Now I'm selling it between dates. Two events happen. I sell, and the price might be adjusted. I might not get as much as I had paid for it. So I might lose a little money on it. You might sell it at a premium. But in this case, I said bond interest rates were going up. Who's going to want my 2% bond? Nobody. So I'll end up selling it at a lower price. So I might have what would be deemed a loss on that bond. But what else happens in between dates is I'm also either having to kind of pay the interest or get the interest back from someone. So if the interest pays January 1st and July 1st, and I sell that bond on April 1st, I, in essence, earned 3 months of interest. So when I sell that bond, I'm going to sell it for whatever price, but I want to say, hey, guy who's going to get my bond on July 1st and my interest for 6 months, I deserved 3 months of that. So when you're buying and selling bonds in between dates, you're also allocating a portion of the interest. Wonderfully, when you're working through a brokerage account or a broker, you're going to have this happen spontaneously. So on your statements, you will see an adjustment for that interest, or you want to look for that. And sometimes it's on the back pages of your 1099. So you have to be careful and make sure you read them, because there could be allocations for what we call accrued interest. All right. Sometimes there's interest that we have to amortize, and it can get complicated. But luckily for us, the brokerage houses are getting much better about reporting the interest that we have when it's between dates. All right. So you've got to look for those extra pages. So when your accountant asks you for the 1099, don't send them just page one. If it's a 15-page 1099, send them the whole thing. So there's adjustments for that interest. All right, so quickly, ordinary interest. We have bank, savings accounts, CDs, corporate bonds, tax-exempt interest. We have municipal bonds and certain U.S. direct obligations that will have tax favor treatment, not for federal, but definitely for state and local. All right. We'll recap that when we come back. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. WDIY, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices, and tonight we're talking about basically interest and dividends, and who knew how convoluted it could get and how interesting it could get as well. So we've just talked about the basics of interest. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810, and we take questions live on air, or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, just give your question to Lori C. in the studio, and she'll write it down and bring it in to me. All right, 610-758-8810. Some other types of interest before I finish my discussion on savings bonds, because I want to spend a little time on that in just a minute. Some other important characteristics of interest that you have to pay attention to, because you may be faced with it someday, is something called nominee interest. What is nominee interest? Actually, nominee interest is interest that was actually reported in somebody else's name and social security number, but it really belongs to you. When would you have those kinds of situations? Well, occasionally you'll see family members, maybe a brother and sister who might have a joint account for some reason and have just decided to keep it that way. And so they both want to report their share of the interest. So you'll have a 1099. It'll be reported in one person's ID number. But maybe that interest is $500. And, you know, it's not all mine. It's my brother's, too. And I don't want to report the whole $500. So what I'll do is I have $500 on my tax return in my ID, less one half nominee interest to brother, and here's his social security number, and I subtract $250. And then brother puts on his tax return nominee interest from sister and my name and social security number. And that's how we make sure and help the IRS match up the reporting of that interest that was on that 1099 of $500, because now they're only going to see $250 on my return and $250 on brother's return. So nominee interest, think nominee, name, someone else's name. We might have nominee interest also when someone has passed away. Sometimes your decedent died and the executor might not have changed the bank account over timely. So if you have interest in a decedent's name, maybe while they were alive for 5 months, it was $500, they died and the bank account didn't get changed over for three more months, and there was $300 of interest earned after date of death. Well, on the decedent's income tax return, we have $800 for the whole year. It was reported in their social security number, less the nominee amount to the estate in my example. So we take $300 off the personal return. So that's nominee interest. So that's a little quirky thing. We also might see personal interest, such as seller financed mortgage interest. So when you have occasionally you might have parents who are well off, have plenty of money, and are conservative and don't want to put too much in the market, and they have this money sitting in the bank, $300,000, not earning very much, and now their really great kid comes to them and said, "Hey, Mom and Dad, I want to buy a house. I don't have enough for a down payment. Any chance you'll give me a loan?" Mom and Dad say, "Hey, son or daughter, you don't need to take a loan and pay 4% to the bank. I can give you a loan of 2%. Dad and mom might be happy to make a loan to kid for 2% when they're going to earn 2% from kid Whereas in the bank, they're earning, you know, 0.5%. So that could be a good deal for mom and dad and for son. That is a private loan, family loan, and there's certain interest rates that are allowed for that. We look at something called AFR rates and the applicable federal rate, and there's guidelines on factoring what kind of interest rate, you know, it would be typical for these kinds of loans, depending on how long the loans are, how much the loans are. So if you plan on doing any kind of loaning or gifting or seller finance kind of mortgages, you want to make sure you're doing it the proper way, structure it the proper way, make sure you're using the right rates. Typically, it's very easy to run amortization schedules. You have the amortization schedule in the file. Some jurisdictions may require a mortgage to be recorded. I don't believe that's the case in all jurisdictions, so you want to make sure you talk to a lawyer about, is there any legal requirements around this? The reason if you are making a loan for a home is, parents, you're going to be reporting that interest income on that loan that your child is paying you, but the child, if the loan is secured by the home, that's a mortgage, and they can then deduct the mortgage interest on their tax return on Schedule A if they itemize deductions. So occasionally you will have what we'll call kind of personal interest on a return. This could happen whether it's a mortgage or just a loan. It could just be a loan between two parties. It could be a loan between friends. Whatever, you want to make sure that you're reporting the interest income if it's a valid loan and note and you have written it up. Occasionally you'll have people who say, well, let's have this loan. You're going to pay me this money. We're going to document this. But hey, you know what? You don't really have to pay me. You know, that's between you and me. We're just going to, you know, do this on the side. Well, the IRS will impute income on loans such as this. So you do want to make sure that you're properly recording it as the situation deems to be reported properly. So you want to do that because the IRS might make you report that loan interest income even if you don't receive it and that person doesn't pay you. Okay, we call that imputed income. All right, so I suggest you get advice when you're working on that. Now let me talk about savings bond interest for a moment. I mentioned U.S. direct obligations, so savings, loans, bills, bonds, notes, treasury, direct U.S. obligation kind of investments are income taxable for federal, but not for state. So you want to make sure that you understand what investments you have and if there's any element of U.S. obligations in those. Sometimes we see those in mutual funds. If you invest in a mutual fund that's sometimes a balanced fund, there may be a portion of U.S. treasuries in that balanced fund. That's why they send you all that extra information with your 1099. So you get a 1099 and it's a thick envelope with 30 pages in it. Flip through it once in a while. One whole packet might be instructions of how to read your 1099. After you glance at that, you can throw it away. But then there will be sometimes the percentages that the mutual funds are invested in U.S. obligations. Or if you have tax-exempt municipal funds, tax-exempt mutual funds, there will be a page that says what percent is for the various states. So you could have XYZ mutual municipal fund, federal tax exempt, but I don't know how much they were invested in Pennsylvania municipals. You look at that sheet, it might say 10% Pennsylvania, then 10% of that fund would be tax exempt for Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania also has tax exempt for obligations for Guam and Puerto Rico. So you want to look at those lists, add up those percentages, and that is what would be tax exempt for Pennsylvania. Hey, let me give you a little clue, retired people. If you're exempt from tax for Pennsylvania anyway, you don't need to worry about going through those calculations necessarily, okay? So some people qualify for something called special tax forgiveness. Then I wouldn't spend too much time figuring out your tax-exempt portion of your municipal income because it might not matter. All right, folks, I will tell you a little bit more about savings bonds when I come back from my next break. I'm going to tell you about the savings bond calculator for people who have savings bonds. The phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
And you are listening to WDIY, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station, your source for NPR news, public affairs, and a great mix of hand-picked music. Lehigh Valley weather, current conditions, 58 degrees with a few clouds. Tonight, partly cloudy, then patchy fog, lows around 42. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, a slight chance of showers each day with highs in the upper 60s. Sunday, the sun returns with highs around 43 degrees. The time now is 6:31. Now back to your financial choices with our host, Lori Siebert.
Thank you, Jeff. Welcome back, folks. I want to say one more thing about savings bonds. First of all, a lot of people forget they have them. So if you recall that grandma bought your child a savings bond when they were born 30 years ago, and you don't recall ever cashing it, you might want to go look on top of the refrigerator to see if it's there. So savings bonds do mature after, it depends on when they were issued, but typically ballpark 30 years. And if you have not redeemed those bonds, you really just want to do that because they're not making anything after they've matured. And technically, you're supposed to report all of that accrued interest on those savings bonds when they mature. Savings bonds, when you buy savings bonds like EE bonds, let's say you buy a $50 savings bond, you pay $25 for it. And I believe the rule of thumb is the goal is in 20 years, it's going to reach its face value. So in 20 years, your $25 bond is going to be $50. You don't have to hold it for 20 years. You can hold it to maturity. You can redeem it sooner if you need to, if you need the money. They want you to hold it for a certain period of time to make sure that you aren't penalized on the interest or anything. So you want to hold it for a particular period of time. But incentive there for savings bonds is that you don't have to report the interest until you redeem them. You don't have to report the interest until you redeem them. You can, if you make an election to report the accrued interest each year. Sometimes people will do that when it's for their kids and their kids don't have any income or in a very low tax bracket. You might elect to report the accrued interest every year. And then when you eventually redeem the bond, you then won't have to report that income then. I rarely have seen people accrue the interest each year, but it has happened, and I have had people do it, just not very often. So the idea is people buy these savings bonds. You might have them with someone. They might be joint. They might be in your name alone. It might be for your child. If your child's name is on it, have your child go cash the bond, and then it's in their Social Security number. And if your child is in a very low tax bracket, that might be great because then you're not going to pay income tax on it. I really tried to look at this with our own children who had savings bonds who received them as gifts when they were little for their last year of college or even the year before that because I knew they were in a very low tax bracket or actually had no income. So when we cashed the savings bonds, there was, in essence, no tax consequence on those savings bonds. All right, so savings bonds have this accrued interest. Well, how do you know how much accrued interest is there? There is on a government website a savings bond calculator, and I love it. It's just so handy, and you can update it. And the website is treasurydirect.gov, treasurydirect.gov, G-O-V, and there's usually a link there that says savings bond calculator, then you say get started, and if you have the bonds handy, what you can do if you really want an inventory is to put the certificate number on, the bond number on your inventory. They don't need that certificate number for the calculation, though. So some people might not see very well and don't want to take the time to type the, you know, 14 numbers that are on there, however long it is. So you don't need it for the calculation, but I definitely recommend it for the inventory purposes, because some of the numbers can be very similar. And as you cash bonds, you can cross off the ones you're cashing. It's a great way to keep track of it. So the certificate serial number on it, the denomination of the bond. So if it's a $50 face bond, you want to put in $50, and then the date it was issued. So if it was issued January of 1990, you put January 1990, $50 bond. What kind of bond? EE bond. You go through these checks, and then you can add. And you just add all of the bonds that you have into your inventory and the date you want it valued. So if you want a current valuation, and boom, you get your valuation. It'll tell you the maturity date. It'll tell you the current interest rate. It will tell you the accrued interest to date. So you get a lot of information with that inventory. And then if you want to update it a year later, if you've saved it properly in your own directory, when you go back into that website, you pull up that inventory and it can automatically update it. So very important to have. So I mentioned that some people may elect to report the interest annually. Another time you get an election is when someone dies. So if you have someone who has passed away and you find oodles and stacks of savings bonds that are good bonds that were just never redeemed, possibly matured, some might have matured, some might not have matured yet, there is an election you can make on the decedent's final lifetime income tax return to report all of the interest accrued to their date of death. Sometimes that's a good election to make because the decedent might have been in a very low tax bracket. They might have had huge medical expenses in their last year, and they could afford to have all this extra income on their return. If you do that, then the interest accrued to the date of death is all reported. Now the estate or the beneficiary, whomever goes to cash those remaining bonds, will get a 1099 showing the full amount of the interest, and you have to back out the amount that was elected to be reported on the final return. So you want to make sure you're working closely with the executor and or attorney that if that election was made, that you don't double count the interest. So typically what I do is have an inventory made. If we've made that election on the final decedent's 1040, I make sure that my beneficiary, if they're taking over the bonds, has that schedule so they know how much to back out. Because if now they've earned an extra $20 of interest, they will have to report the $20 since date of death, but they won't have to report the $1,000 that was before date of death because we reported it all in the final return. All right, folks, I think I'm giving a lot of details tonight, and I hope it's not over people's heads, but I like people to be aware because a lot of people aren't. And there's a lot of opportunities here, a lot of planning opportunities, and especially income tax, preferences that people have to understand for federal and state purposes. So that's kind of the story on that. So check out treasurydirect.gov if you have savings bonds. I also want to mention that if folks have non-qualified annuities that they've bought an annuity, they've made an investment in an annuity. It's not in an IRA, it's just an investment, non-qualified. That's what that means, not in an IRA or retirement account. If you have a non-qualified annuity and you take a distribution from it, the general rule typically now is when you take a distribution from your non-qualified annuity, the earnings come out first. So When that comes out on page one of your federal return, that's reported with a 1099-R under annuities. But for Pennsylvania purposes, it has to be reported as interest. So you want to make sure you're reporting that properly. Otherwise, you might get a notice on that. We have a call on line one. I have Lee. Hi, Lee. Can you hear me? Hello, Lee. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, there you go. I can hear you now. How can I help you?
Great. I just was wondering if I should be expecting interest reporting forms for a Roth IRA that I have.
No, you probably won't. What happens with a Roth IRA, you've made an investment in a Roth IRA, and maybe you've had it for several years now. Maybe you just did it. What happens, any gains on that Roth IRA, when you eventually take it out, if you take it out, because you don't, you won't be required to take it out. So there isn't, that income is just building up, and it's all going to be tax-free as long as you wait the longer of 5 years or age 59 and a half to take it out. So any earnings, they don't report that. But what you might get, Lee, is a form called a 5498, and that is an informational filing only. And your custodian or bank or wherever you have your Roth IRA will report to the IRS the balance in your Roth IRA. And on that form, they might say if you've made any contributions to it or distributions. But it's just an informational reporting. Otherwise, you would only get something for the Roth IRA for tax purposes when you take a distribution out.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, greatly. Thank you for calling. Have a good
You're
night.
Welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye. Folks, I do, to Lee's question about Roth IRA, I do like people to keep track of how much they put into the Roth IRA, because one of the great things about a Roth IRA is you can always take out your original contributions. So if you're, you know, if you've done it for retirement, you never plan to take the money out ever, maybe you want to use it as an estate planning tool, investment vehicle. You don't have any required minimum distributions out of a regular Roth IRA, then you may not need to know the cost basis or what you've put into it. But for people who might be starting out young and it's a way to fund retirement and you start putting money in it, and maybe 10 years from now you realize you're going to buy a house and you want a down payment, you need $5,000 more, and you knew that you put this money in your Roth, you can always take out the original contribution without any problems. So you want to track your cost basis in a Roth IRA on Form 8606 if you think that's applicable. All right. Folks, if you do have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. 610-758-8810. Real quick, dividends. Dividends, we get a 1099 div, D-I-V on dividends. We have qualified dividends and ordinary dividends. And a lot of people get confused when they get the 1099. Sometimes they think they have two different kinds of dividends and include both of them on the return. But what you have to know is the box that says qualified dividends is just a subset of the ordinary dividends. So if your 1099 div says $1,000 of ordinary dividends and $800 of qualified dividends, what that means is 800 of your 1,000 qualifies for a lower tax rate. That's all it's telling you, that there's a certain part of those total dividends that qualify for a lower tax rate. And that lower tax rate is the capital gains tax rate. The capital gains tax rate could be zero, it could be 15, and it could be 20. Zero sounds pretty good. So you want to make sure that if you have qualified dividends, that you record those properly in your software or on your tax return, because they have the potential to qualify for a lower tax rate. That's the capital gains tax rate. It depends on what income bracket you're in. For people who are in a 15% or lower tax bracket, your qualified dividends are going to be taxed at zero to the extent they're in that bracket. So even if you think your income goes up into the 25% bracket, some of it still might be getting taxed at lower rates. So it's very important you have good software or know how to use the worksheets from the IRS. Qualified dividends qualify for a lower tax rate. Now, it won't matter for Pennsylvania state, it's the total dividends they're taxing. They don't care if they're qualified or not. But generally, you can rely on the custodian to properly report the character of that dividend. Once in a while, we'll see dividends and I'll be surprised, like, why isn't this qualified? This doesn't make sense. This is a PPL dividend. These are normally qualified. There are certain dividends that don't qualify for the special tax rate, the special treatment. They're not considered qualified. And those might be from an ESOP, an employer stock ownership plan, where you have this qualified plan at work, you're investing in employer stock, but they have to pay out the dividends to you. And if they pay out the dividends to you from an ESOP, those aren't considered qualified, so they're not going to qualify for the lower tax rate. Also, if you didn't hold the position for the required period of time or you shorted a position. And again, hopefully your custodian will keep track of that for you. Folks, we're taking our last break. If you have questions, I love them. The phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. We're talking about Schedule B, interest and dividends. Talking a little fast tonight. I'm a little hyper. Regular listeners know sometimes I come in kind of quiet and my energy level just goes through the roof as I go through the show. I hope I haven't spoken too quickly for people, but I do hope that I have demonstrated that it's very important to understand your tax documents and the implications of them, because it could affect your taxes that you're paying for federal and for state. And it just helps you make more informed decisions about your own investments when you realize there's different tax characteristics on the different kinds of investments that you have. I want to mention that some people might get confused about certain things, about whether they're interest or dividends. So, for example, you get a statement from your bank, your credit union, and your credit union says they've paid you dividends. It isn't really dividends. Credit union dividends are really interest, and you will get a 1099 INT for that. So don't be confused by that, and it does not qualify for a special tax rate. Sometimes people will have on their dividend schedule a box that says non-taxable distribution, and they'll think, oh, wow, cool. I love this fund. I'm getting a non-taxable distribution. You can't beat that. Well, that's because it's a return of your own money. So don't get so excited. What that does is it reduces your basis in whatever that investment is. So a non-taxable distribution is a return of your own money. You have to lower the basis. Life insurance dividends. People get confused by this. Sometimes they'll bring in that piece of paper they get from the life insurance company that says accrued dividend or something like that. Dividends up from life insurance companies are typically a return of your premiums. And until you exceed the premiums that you've paid into the company for that life insurance, they're not taxable. So it might say, here, Lori, here's your dividend on this life insurance. And I've paid, you know, here's $100. And over my life, I've paid premiums of $10,000. Well, that $100 isn't going to be taxable. It's just a return of the premium. Once you exceed the premiums that you've paid in and the distributions from the life insurance company come in and they exceed the premiums you've paid in, then that becomes taxable, and that is going to be taxable interest. And the insurance company will send you a 1099 INT for that interest. Occasionally, we will see withholdings, like federal tax withholdings on interest statements or dividend statements. And you might say, why are they withholding federal tax from my dividends, from my brokerage account or my bank account? I don't understand. Quite often, the issue is that you might not have completed a form called a W-9. A W-9 is something you typically complete when you're opening up an account, a bank account or whatever, with your Social Security number and your address. If you haven't done that or you fail to do that, then the institution will be required to do backup withholding on your income, on your dividends and interest. Typically, when I see this for clients, I'll just give them a buzz and say, hey, you know what? Contact this institution. Tell them you have backup withholding and you need to complete a W-9. What do you need to do? W-9 is a simple form you can find on the IRS website, but you also need to know where to send it so they can correct it so that you no longer have the backup withholding. Another item to mention when we get a 1099 div, it might show those qualified dividends and ordinary dividends, and there might also be a box that says capital gain distributions. Typically, what that's from is if you invest in mutual funds, and that mutual fund is a bucket of stocks or bonds, right? And that money manager of that mutual fund is buying and selling during the year, buying and selling. And at the end of the year, they, you know, balance out their books and they say, hey, you had this much gain, investor, and part of that gain in this mutual fund is getting allocated to you for whatever portion of the fund you might have owned, and they'll issue you part of the gain, and it might be, you know, $100. So that $100 is on your 1099 div as a capital gain, and it qualifies for capital gain tax rates. That capital gain, if you have other sales of investments, then you're having to report those on Schedule D. D is in David, and there is a line on that schedule to show your capital gain distributions. If you don't have any other sales and you don't have to fill out the Schedule D, there is a line on page one of the return where you report your capital gains, and there's a box that you check that says, I don't have to fill out Schedule D, I just have these capital gains. So that works lovely. What happens though on your state return is the capital gain distributions are considered dividends and they're added to your dividends. The little rub there is for federal purposes, if I have capital losses from other investments that I've sold or I have a capital loss carry forward, I get to use those against my capital gain distributions from my mutual funds. For Pennsylvania purposes, I could have some losses on some investments I made. If that capital gain is getting reported as a dividend, I don't get to use those losses against it. So that's a little rub there and a difference between federal and state. Well, in Pennsylvania, because most states, quite a few states, follow the federal rules, but Pennsylvania does not. So you want to watch out for that kind of thing. So there were two big differences I just mentioned. One earlier about the non-qualified annuity income gains getting taxed as interest on Pennsylvania, and then the capital gain distributions for federal Schedule D, special tax rates, capital losses can offset them, but not for Pennsylvania. They're considered dividends. Now, I've talked about 1099 INT, I've talked about 1099 DIV, and all of a sudden you get in the mail something called a consolidated 1099. What the heck is that? Lori said I was going to get a 1099 INT or DIV. The consolidated 1099, or sometimes they might be called the composite 1099, is typically what we see from a brokerage firm where you may have investments, where you might have CDs, you might have corporate bonds, you might have municipal bonds, dividends, stocks, mutual funds that have all of what we've already talked about, interest and dividends and all of those different kinds that we mentioned earlier in the show. It is very convenient that they can report all of this on one tax document. Included in the consolidated 1099 or the composite, though, is also something which I didn't talk about tonight, which are those sales of investments that we have, where whether we're selling bonds or stocks or mutual funds or bond mutual funds. And that is reported on a 1099-B, B as in boy. So the consolidated will include the INT, the DIV, the B, 1099-B, all of those transactions. And then sometimes the supplemental reporting for maybe premiums or discounts on bonds that you may have bought or sold, and additional information, which might also include the percentages for funds that you might have had. And not all firms have those in their packet. So you might have to go look up, because if you do your brokerage at just one of the big houses, they might not give you the paperwork for all of the different U.S. Treasury obligation kind of investments you had in each of your mutual funds. You might have to go look that up separately. So may or may not be worth it. If it's immaterial, it might not be worth it. We only pay 3.07% Pennsylvania income tax. And if you're U.S. Treasury portion of your $100 dividend is $3, it's not worth the calculation. So you want to make sure it's material or not. One other thing that we see at the bottom of our Schedule B is a question about, do you have any foreign bank accounts or signature authority over any foreign bank accounts? Those are becoming more important questions as we see more and more people having foreign bank accounts, because we just have a more diverse community, well, at least for now, a more diverse community with people who may have holdings in foreign countries, relatives in foreign countries. Maybe you have signature authority over mom's account in, England or India or somewhere. So you may end up having to answer some of these questions. If you have a foreign bank account, but the balance in it was never more than $10,000, you can answer that you had a foreign bank account, but there's no further reporting that you would have to do. But if you have a foreign bank account, and I was trying to, let me grab the page here, it can get quite complicated. So really what I want to do is just point out that if you have foreign bank accounts, foreign investments, it's really important to make sure that you're talking to someone who knows what they're doing and helps you prepare the proper forms. There is something called the FinCEN Form 114. It's a report of foreign bank and financial accounts. They tried to combine this more recently from what they had in the past, where the bank reporting was separate from the financial account reporting. So you might have to complete one of those. And then there's also a form 8938, which is called a Statement of Specified Foreign Financial Assets. And depending on how large those accounts were during the year, and there's some very specific instructions for that. Married, filing, joint, 100,000, and on the last day of the year, if it was 150,000. So all kinds of numbers that you have to really pay attention to, and that's Form 8938. You want to make sure if any of those apply to you. Also, if you happen to be someone who's received any receipts from foreign trust or receipt of certain foreign gifts, there's a form called 3520, and that is filled out separately from the 1040. So you have to make sure that you're reporting those certain transactions with foreign trust, ownership of foreign trust, and receipt of certain large gifts or bequests from certain foreign persons. So just a little heads up, if you have any kind of foreign transactions, you want to make sure you're reporting them and reporting them properly, and have the disclosure, because the penalties on this stuff are super high. They've really been cracking down. They have other countries that are helping with the reporting of that. So you want to make sure you're doing the proper reporting. All right, folks, it was a busy show for me. I hope I didn't make anyone's head spin. I'll go home and my husband will tell me I got into too many details, but that's just what I do. So if you have questions, guys, gals, next week, that's what the show is. Listeners, questions. So work on your tax returns. If there's questions, I will be here next week taking calls live on air or off air. You can also send questions through yourfinancialchoices.com. I can answer them on the radio next week. So yourfinancialchoices.com for any tax questions, but basically it's going to be listeners' tax questions next week. I want to thank Jeff for being here, Lori for being here, listeners for calling in. I really appreciate it. Coming up next, we have Tom Druckenmiller with In the Tradition Folk Music. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. Make the best of your financial choices and have a great week.